As we pick up our story today where we left off yesterday, I'd like to do a quick visit back to an event some 30 years previous, as recorded in 1 Kings chapter number 19 at verse number 15. This is all about what God told Elijah to do after the 3.5 year drought was finished and after Elijah had run away from Jezebel, who was trying to kill him after the contest against the prophets of Baal ended with the deaths of her pet prophets. It says here, "He who is said to Elijah, go, return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus. And when you arrive, you shall anoint Hazael to be king over Syria. Jehu, the son of Nimshi, you shall anoint to be king over Israel. And Elisha, the son of Shaphat of Abel-Meholah, you shall anoint to be prophet in your place. And the one who escapes from the sword of Hazael shall Jehu put to death, and the one who escapes from the sword of Jehu shall Elisha put to death." So these were instructions given by God about 30 years previous to Elijah that he was supposed to take care of in order to settle things in the northern kingdom better. Well, the only one of those three that Elijah actually did was anoint Elisha as his replacement. The other two things he took no action on. We know that after Elijah was caught away by God supernaturally, that Elisha did not immediately do the other two things either. He did eventually, at God's direction, go and anoint Jehu as the king over northern Israel, so that Jehu could carry out the execution of the entire Omride dynasty, the dynasty of Omri of northern Israel, the dynasty that included Ahab and Jezebel. But we have still not seen the other thing taken care of for 30 years. And now is the time for that. And so let's turn our attention back to 2 Kings chapter number 8, verse number 7. And we know historically that this Ben-Hadad of Damascus, Syria, ceases being the king of his kingdom, and he's replaced by one of his commanders named Hazael, somewhere between 845 and 843 BC. And so that's just a couple of years after Jehoash has been made the new king of the southern kingdom of Judah. So God is now tying up the last loose ends of reorganizing the Israeli Middle East in a better fashion. So 2 Kings chapter 8, verse 7 says, "Now Elisha came to Damascus." Damascus is about 40, I think, or so miles northeast of the Sea of Galilee, a little bit less than that from the borders of Galilee itself. It's really close. It's the closest kingdom to the north of northern Israel. And they have been a traditional enemy of the northern kingdom of Israel, especially during Ben-Hadad's time on the throne. And Hazael has been the guy prosecuting a lot of the military action on behalf of Ben-Hadad. So Elisha, the Israeli prophet, goes to the city of Damascus for a visit. Ben-Hadad, the king of Syria, was sick. We're not told what he was sick with, just that he's sick. When it was told to him, the man of God has come here, and he's had run-ins with Elisha before and knows that the power of God rests very strongly on him. So here he is sick and in desperate need of healing, and so, you know, any port in a storm. So the king said to Hazael, his commander, take a present with you and go to meet the man of God and inquire of he who is through him, saying, shall I recover from this sickness? So he's going to reach out to the powerful God of the Israelis to see whether or not he can get his sickness taken care of. So Hazael went to meet Elisha, and he took a present with him, all kinds of goods of Damascus, 40 camel loads. Now that's a lot of bribe right there to try to get God to heal him. When he came and he stood before him, he said, your son Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, has sent me to you saying, shall I recover from this sickness? Now that's just polite Middle Eastern wording to try to butter up the prophet. What he really wants to know is, can you put a word in for me with your God, who is very powerful, and get me healed? Elisha said to Hazael, you go, you say to him, you shall certainly recover. But he who is has shown me that he shall certainly die. And then Elisha fixed his gaze and stared at Hazael until he was embarrassed. So Elisha says to Hazael, oh, you can go and tell him he's going to be well. In fact, I know that's what you're going to do. But you and I both know he's not going to get well. And then he just stares at him. Because somehow in Hazael's heart, there's already an assassination plot. There's already a plan for him to kill off his boss so that he can come to power. And Elisha lets this guy know, I know, and God knows what you have in mind. And then, interesting little line here, the man of God wept. So after staring at him for a while, Elisha then breaks into tears and starts sobbing. And he's an older man, remember that. And Hazael is upset by having this powerful senior prophet act in this fashion in his presence. That's just not done. And Hazael said, why does my Lord weep? And he answered, because I know the evil that you will do to the people of Israel. You will set on fire their fortresses. You will kill their young ones with the sword and dash in pieces their little ones and rip open their pregnant women. And so the prophet has seen in his visions Hazael leading a military invasion as the new king of Damascus, Syria, into northern Israel, and killing people right and left. Not just simply combatants, but non-combatants. And butchering little kids and assassinating pregnant women by ripping them open and killing the fetus. Verse 13, Hazael said, what is your servant who's but a dog that he should do this great thing? Now, he's not saying great in the sense of marvelous, but great as in this horrendous thing. He verbalizes that would be a shameful thing for him to do. Now, it's possible that he is protesting what is already in his heart. It could be that he is tired of all the failures of his boss, Ben-Hadad, over the last few decades of trying to annex Israel into the Syrian kingdom of Damascus. Because Ben-Hadad has failed on multiple occasions to get this job done. Yes, there's been some territory taken, but then it was lost back to Israel again. And a lot of Syrians died trying to fight against Israel, mostly because Elijah and Elisha kept providing God's support to the kingdom. So it could be that Hazael's plan is, I am going to kill off this last weak king of the Ben-Hadad line, and then I'm going to show people true strength by taking Israel under control. And that he's just trying to deny his intentions in front of this man. Elisha answered, "He who is has shown me that you to be king over Syria." And then he departed from Elisha and came to his master. And then Elisha apparently goes back to Israel. So Hazael reports back to Ben-Hadad at his sickbed, who said to him, "Well, what did Elisha say to you?" And he answered, "He told me that you would certainly recover." And that's exactly what Elisha said he would tell him. But the next day, and remember, days start at sunset, so probably in the middle of the night, he took the bedcloth and dipped it in water and spread it over his face till he died. So what he does is he assassinates him in a way that it looks like he just died of his sickness in his bed. He doesn't stab him. He doesn't hit him. He just simply takes a wet, soaked piece of material and holds it over his face until he quits breathing. And then he presents the information to the rest of the kingdom that Ben-Hadad is dead, and probably something like, "And I'm the next in line to take over the kingdom." And so Hazael became king in his place. Then we go to 2 Kings chapter number 10. 2 Kings chapter number 10, verse number 32, to talk about what Hazael does next. And again, this is happening somewhere right around 845, 844, or 843 BC, immediately after Hazael becomes the new king of Damascus, Syria. Verse 32, "In those days, he who is began to cut off parts of Israel. Hazael defeated them throughout the territory of Israel." So God is bringing judgment against the northern kingdom, which he told them he was going to do, because they're still not repenting and coming back to him. They are still holding on to their worship of the golden calves of Jeroboam. They're still worshiping the twisted version of He Who Is. And more than likely, they're also starting to see a revival of the Baal and Asherah worship among some of the population. So God permits Hazael to come against the northern kingdom successfully. Verse 33, "From the Jordan eastward, all the land of Gilead, the Gadites and the Reubenites and the Manassites, from Arior, which is by the valley of Arnon, and that is Gilead and Bashan." So when you look on your maps of northern Israel, what has just happened is that Syria has pushed southward throughout what we call the Golan today, the Golan Heights, and taken over all of the territory east of the Sea of Galilee, pushed farther south, and past Ramoth-Gilead, which they used to have kind of an outpost right there. They've pushed past that outpost and taken over all of the eastern bank of the Jordan River, all the way down to the borders with Moab. So Syria, under Hazael, has just annexed a huge portion of the northern kingdom. And their occupation forces did horrendous things in the process, things that were described by the prophet Elisha in the last story. And they are occupying that area, always just a few miles east of the rest of the Israeli territory. And there's one particular man I want you to think about. He's living just a little over a handful of miles from the new border with Syria, because Syria is now occupying the Golan, and that would be Jonah the prophet from Gath Hepher on the west side of the Sea of Galilee, in Galilee proper. Next thing we have to come to is historical. This is not listed in our Bibles, other than something that's going to be tied into the Jonah story, which is why I brought him up at this point. And that is that we know that in 842 BC, so just a year or so after Hazael invades and takes over and annexes the eastern side of northern Israel, a king by the name of Shalmaneser III of Assyria, which is north of Syria, invaded all of the territory that was held by Aram, or Syria, and that included all the territory that Hazael just took over. And this is something that you should understand about the Assyrians. They were the Nazis of their day. They were the believers in their genetic group were the superhumans, that all other people were basically cattle and resources to be exploited. And so when the Assyrians swept through, death and destruction and atrocities occurred. There have been reports in some of the ancient writings of how they made furniture out of the skins of the conquered peoples. And that's very similar to some of the atrocities we hear of the Nazis against those that they did not consider to be truly human. So when the Assyrians came through the eastern portion of northern Israel, they committed those same atrocities against Israelis that had been there occupied by the Syrians. So the Syrians were bad enough. The Assyrians were horrendous. And that is why the prophet Jonah despises the Assyrians, because of the atrocities that they committed. Now, in 841 BC, Jehu of Israel, the king that we've been talking about in northern Israel, paid tribute to this Shalmaneser III. And this is depicted upon the black obelisk of Shalmaneser that was erected in 825 BC, shortly before King Shalmaneser died. And it is one of the few depictions we have of an ancient Israeli king. And in this depiction, he is on his hands and feet and his face in front of Shalmaneser III. So all of that we know from history, that things went badly in the 840s BC for northern Israel. Then we go to 825 BC and the death of King Jehu. 2 Kings chapter number 10, verse 34. Now the rest of the acts of Jehu and all that he did, and all his might, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel? So Jehu slept with his fathers, and they buried him in Samaria, and Jehoahaz, his son, became king in his place. The time that Jehu reigned over Israel in Samaria was 28 years. Then from there we jump forward, because remember, these books tell little encapsulated stories from both the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. So in order to get these things in their chronological orders, we have to kind of bounce around sometimes. So 2 Kings 13:1 is where we can find our dating information. In the 23rd year of Joash, the son of Ahaziah, king of Judah, Jehoahaz, the son of Jehu, began to reign over Israel in Samaria, and he reigned 17 years. So there's our summary about him. Verse 2, let's talk about his morality. He did what was evil in the sight of he who is, and followed the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, which he made Israel to sin. He did not depart from them. So again, a reminder, the sin of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, is the golden calf, the golden calf worship, the golden calf religion. So Jehoahaz continues down that twisted worship path, which brings God's anger upon him. But we'll have to talk about him later, because now we have to go back to the story of the southern kingdom. And for this one, we have to go to 2 Kings chapter 12, verse number 4, and pick up the story of Jehoash, the king of southern Judah, and his uncle, who is Jehoiada, the high priest of the southern kingdom. And Jehoash had apparently directed his uncle to take care of the temple, to get it back up, running the way it should, after the years of neglect under Athaliah. And so we come to his 23rd year, and there's a problem. 2 Kings chapter 12, verse 4. Jehoash said to the priests, "All the money of the holy things that is brought into the house of he who is, the money for which each man is assessed, the money for the assessment of persons, and the money that a man's heart prompts him to bring into the house of he who is, let the priest take it each from his donor, and let them repair the house wherever any need of repairs is discovered." So that had gone out earlier in the kingdom of Jehoash. Every year, all the adult males have to pay a temple tax. It's enough money, a couple of days' wages, that the upkeep of the temple can occur. Well, Jehoash is saying, "I want all of that money diverted to getting the temple back up to its pristine condition." And Jehoiada was supposed to be the one taking care of that. Verse 6, "But by the 23rd year of King Jehoash, the priests had made no repairs on the house." So where's this money going to? It's not being used for the repair of the temple. "Therefore, King Jehoash summoned Jehoiada the priest and the other priests and said to them, 'Why are you not repairing the house? Now therefore take no more money from your donors, but hand it over for the repair of the house.'" So he says, enough of this taking money and diverting it somewhere else. Stop it. Get the repairs done. So the priests agreed that they should take no more money from the people and that they should not repair the house. And so Jehoiada the priest took a chest, and he bored a hole in the lid of it, and he set it beside the altar on the right side as one entered the house of he who is. and the priests who guarded the threshold put in it all the money that was brought into the house of He Who Is. And whenever they saw that there was much money in the chest, the king's secretary and the high priest came up, and they bagged and they counted the money that it was found in the house of He Who Is. So apparently what we've got here is an accountability issue. Jehoiada seems to have been a good man and wanted to get the repair work done, but some of the priests down lower than him were unscrupulous, and they're diverting the money elsewhere. So Jehoiada gets a lockbox, and he puts it in a secure area with guards around it, and he makes sure that all the money gets put in there that's supposed to be used for the rebuilding of the temple, the repairing of the temple. And then they empty that box from time to time and account for the money. And then, verse 11, they would give that money that was weighed out into the hands of the workmen who had the oversight of the house of He Who Is. And they paid it out to the carpenters and the builders who worked in the house of He Who Is, to the masons and the stonecutters, as well as to buy timber and quarried stones for making repairs to the house of He Who Is, and for any outlay for the repairs of the house. So they are doing their best to try to get Solomon's temple back up to its standard. But there was not made for the house of He Who Is basins of silver, for the money that was brought into the house, basins of silver, snuffers, bowls, trumpets, or any vessels of gold or silver from the money that was brought into the house of He Who Is. Some of those things probably went missing during the years of Athaliah. They're not being repaid out of these funds. For that was given to the workmen who were repairing the house of the Lord with it. And they did not ask for accounting from the men into whose hand they delivered the money to pay out the workmen, for they dealt honestly. And the money from the guild offerings and the money from the sin offerings was not brought into the house of He Who Is. It belonged to the priests. So we've got a major renovation project happening, and we will come back and talk a little bit more about that next time we get into God's Word.